The White Network presents The Heretics Hour with Carolyn Yeager.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'm finding my place here. This is Carolyn Yeager, and I want to welcome you to the April 22nd, 2013 edition of the Heretics Hour. I'm your host, and for the next 2 hours. The topic tonight is a little bit loose, but it was inspired from a comment to the White Network from a listener to Saturday's program on Adolf Hitler's birthday. The comment was from Marcus, spelled with a K, M-A-R-K-U-S, someone who comes across as pro-Germany and even appears to know the German language and to write often about German issues and to be well-read. And Marcus has written comments quite a few, not quite a few, I shouldn't say that, but, you know, once in a while at the White Network. And this time he asked a question of me. He talked about some other things, and then he included a question, and this was about Saturday's show on Adolf Hitler's birthday. And he asked, why did I think Hitler did not address the nation considering the defeat, but rather killed himself before ever signing the surrender? He compares that to Japan's emperor, who addressed the Japanese people about the decision to surrender. He said that he was of the opinion that the Germans were lost and in emotional trauma because of this, because Hitler did not ever speak to them concerning the upcoming defeat or surrender or whatever, as the Emperor Hirohito did in Japan. Well, you know, I thought I should answer this. I thought I could answer it pretty quick, but then I decided it was best to look up some facts first, so I didn't get things, you know, miss out on things and forget things and maybe didn't know that much about it. So I did look it up, and when I was reading on it, I decided I wanted to study the whole period and to get a better understanding of it, and I decided to turn it into a program. So that's tonight's program. With the working title that I gave it is Comparing the German and Japanese Surrender to the Allies. That might remain the title, or I might change it, but seems about as good as a description of what this show is going to be, although there's going to be some other things too, because we're still dealing with anniversaries, because April 22nd, that's today's date, was the day in 1945 that Hitler was informed that the order he had issued the previous day for the SS General Felix Steiner's army detachment to move to the rescue of Berlin had not materialized, or Steiner had not shown up. He couldn't, you know, he was unable to. So it is said that Hitler uttered the words on this day, "The war is lost," the first time he ever said that. So this today we could, I suppose, mark April 22nd as beginning of the last days for sure, and this lasted until the formal surrender on May 7th and 8th. Now we'll cover much of this tonight, and we'll cover the final days of the Japanese Empire also in the form that it was in. And compare them and see, you know, what kind of answers we come up to Marcus's questions. Now, there's another anniversary coming up shortly, which I don't want to ignore. And that is on this Friday, April 26th. It's the 100th anniversary of the murder of Mary Fagan in Atlanta, Georgia. It should not be doubted that her murderer was Leo Frank. But what I'm more interested in is the birth of the ADL in October of that year in response to Drury's attempts to exonerate Frank in the court. This was a situation that needed some serious management in their eyes, and this year, 2013, is therefore also the 100th anniversary of the ADL, the anniversary of Mary Fagan's murder and the anniversary of the ADL, because they coincided, and for good reason. They're very, very much, much associated with one another. The ADL was formed, as I already said, in October. The murder took place in April. And the murder is what demanded the formation of the League, the Anti-Defamation League. So I'll get into that possibly in the second hour, and let me remind you that, I don't know what good it does to give the phone number now, but I will be take calls in the second hour after the break, and the number is 1-830-443-4911, and that number is on the front page of the White Network up at the top where you have the streaming audio and where you click to, you know, you listen to this show, where you can listen to the show live. So, oh, excuse me. All right. You know, I have a little bit of a cough drop that I suck on at the beginning of the, before the show starts. And then it causes me to have this kind of hiccupy thing. Just a cough drop. So strange. I don't know if it helps me or not. Sometimes it does. I don't think it did tonight. Anyway, back to the questions now after me. No, I'm not. Something else I wanted to say. I'll begin with thanking Elizabeth from the United Kingdom for her donation to me on April 20th. And I want to draw your attention to part one. Well, I should also thank Dimitar. He tells me not to bother. But he sends something every month. He's a good, good, faithful guy. Dimitar in Canada. I want to draw your attention to part one also of the Odyssey of Fanon Junker Wenger, which was posted at my Carolyn Yeager website last week. And I'm soon going to be adding part two of the conclusion of this fascinating real-life account, which took place at the end of World War II. So, again, we're in the same period. It was from April to July 1945, the end of the fighting, and then the efforts to get back home. That was very, very interesting. So it fits right in with these dates for today's show. Also, I'm really proud to have that on my website. And I might say a little more about it at a later time. So that's a lot of things that converge at the end of April. Back to now the question asked by Marcus. He actually wrote, why do you think Hitler did not address the nation, considering the defeat, but rather killed himself before ever signing the surrender? The Germans were lost and in emotional trauma, in my opinion, because of this. But then he goes on and says, or could it also be that he was actually captured by the Russians, and the two versions of his whereabouts of either committing suicide or escaping to Argentina were both false? Well, I was kind of amazed that he put that in there, because I was starting to think of Marcus as a good thinking fellow. But, you know, sometimes he's written things that I didn't take very well. And I thought, well, maybe I was just mistaken and I should have, you know, formed my judgment too soon or something. But now here again, why is someone who seems to know so much about Germany and be so pro-German, why does he come up with something like this? It's just bizarre to me. Now, was Hitler captured by the Russians? I'll just go into this right away. Of course not. And he would not have allowed that to happen. And that's why he did, partly why he did what he did, when he did. So that he couldn't be captured by the Russians. That was the last thing he would have allowed to happen. So that didn't happen. And what's the other one? Or that he committed suicide. Certainly people should accept that Hitler committed suicide in the bunker on April 29th. It just doesn't make any sense to entertain these other ideas about escaping to Argentina or to somewhere, you know, wherever he might have escaped to. They're just people who indulge in that are just like, they don't know anything, and they just like far out stories. and they like stuff about Hitler like that. They just, you know, it's just a kind of an entertainment. It's not, it shouldn't be taken seriously. And I'm really surprised that, this Marcus, even brought this up. So anyway, we won't go into that anymore. Then he went on to say, to compare what Hitler did with saying, when you watch the speech of Japan's emperor regarding Japan's surrender, you see the people bowing to the loudspeakers by the 1,000s. It was hard to accept for them, but they could prepare themselves to what was coming and keep their national solidarity and integrity. Well, do you think that that is what happened? Does he think that it was because of that speech, that recorded address by the emperor, that caused the Japanese to keep their national solidarity and integrity? The evidence does not point to that. It didn't really have much of an effect. And we'll get into that. I won't jump the gun and say why, but most of the people, couldn't even understand what he was saying. And naturally they'd bow. They're bowing to the loudspeaker. They had never heard their emperor's voice before. I'll just say this now. That was the first time that he had ever spoken publicly, and it was on a recording. You know, I don't know if they'd ever seen him. Maybe he came out and, moved about here and there. I don't know. I would think so, but they never heard him. He never spoke to them before this. And whereas Hitler had been speaking to his people and out and about and meeting his people and greeting his people for years and years, you know, so it's not like the people felt that he was, you know, somehow aloof, or he was not, you know, was not thinking about them or didn't have a message for them. They knew what it was. Goebbels had been giving speeches and been on the radio, right up close to the end. And he had been saying what was, you know, he was right there with Hitler. He'd been saying, you know, what Hitler would have, accepted. But there's other reasons why he didn't. But this is a real contrast between between thinking that somehow the emperor made some kind of connection with the people, that Hitler didn't, and left the people, the Germans, lost and in trauma. That the emperor was not able to protect the Japanese people from the trauma they experienced, nor did Hitler increase their trauma because he didn't give a speech. But there's a lot more to it than that. So, I'm going to get into it and just kind of go through what happened in Japan and how it all came about and how they were treated, and then go back to Germany. But first, that the situation in and the attitude toward Japan and toward Germany was different. There's a lot of differences, and this one way it can be seen is in the conditions put forth by the Yalta Conference and then the Potsdam Agreement. You know, right off the bat, Germany was to be divided and into occupation zones. And there was a Morgenthau program, which had been known about for quite some time, what that was going to amount to, and how Germany was going to be simply dismantled and taken over and undone, you know. And this, whereas I don't know if the... I don't know what had been said about the Japanese, what was going to happen in Japan prior to the surrender demands. But in the end, Hirohito was allowed to live and continue his reign over his people in the land of the rising sun. And there were political reasons for that, or reasons that I think can be stated. So it was all a very different situation. So let's say... Let me go to Japan. All right. Japan didn't surrender until August, whereas Germany surrendered in May. So Japan was still fighting. And on June 22nd, Germany was already taken over by the Allies. But the emperor met with his ministers, and because things weren't looking too good, and said that he desired that concrete plans to end the war, unhampered by existing policy, be speedily studied, and that efforts be made to implement them. And this was, they attempted then to negotiate a peace via the Soviet Union, but that came to nothing. Again, nobody could, you know, neither one of these countries could negotiate any kind of a peace. There was no willingness on the part of their enemies to negotiate anything. So, on July 26, 1945, we had the Potsdam Declaration was issued, and it demanded unconditional surrender from Japan. And it was mostly concerned with European interests, but they had there's some interesting stuff here. At the Potsdam conference, at the Tehran and Yalta conferences, the U.S. had lobbied hard for its own what it wanted, and high on its list of priorities was shortening the war and reducing American casualties to keep the public on their side. So, and Soviet intervention seemed likely to do both, but also it was at the cost of possibly allowing the Soviets to capture territory beyond that which had been promised them, at Tehran and Yalta. So here is where, the United States' greatest interest at this point, knowing that it was going to win, knowing that the outcome was certain, in Japan too, was wanting to reduce American casualties. And it didn't matter what kind of casualties were inflicted on the other side, and it wasn't out of love for American service people either. It was because, for political reasons, now the war was coming to an end, and they were still wanted to be reelected. These were all politicians, whether they're presidents or whatever, and members of the government, and they wanted their side to be seen in the best light possible. They didn't want after it was all over, for the Americans to say, well, we went through all this, it cost us all these lives, and we're not happy about what happened. So they wanted to give a real good spin on the war, and they wanted at this point to cut down casualties. So that's why they used the bomb on Japan. But in any case, the Potsdam Declaration stated clearly. Now, this is Potsdam. Germany's already under the occupation. But they said, we do not intend that the Japanese shall be enslaved as a race or destroyed as a nation. Of course, that could be just words. But they did actually not destroy Japan the way they destroyed Germany. And the Japanese government shall remove all obstacles to the revival and strengthening of democratic tendencies among the Japanese people. They insisted that there be freedom of speech, of religion, and of thought. Of religion, because Japan was totally dominated by the Shinto religion, and the emperor's family was, in that Shinto traditions and so on. But now they want to change it all, free speech, democracy, any kind of religion you want, freedom of thought, and respect for the fundamental human rights, that all will be established in Japan. But they say Japan shall be permitted to maintain such industries as will sustain her economy and permit the exaction of just reparations in kind, and Japanese participation in world trade relations shall be permitted. So that's a big difference from what they were allowing Germany. They said that she would maintain her industries, where in Germany they were all taken apart and they were not allowed to have any kind of heavy industry. And the Japanese would still participate in world trade as Japanese, and that would be permitted. And they say the occupying forces would be withdrawn from Japan as soon as these objectives had been accomplished, and they got the kind of responsible government in there that they wanted. And they said that it said that that they called upon the government of Japan to proclaim the unconditional surrender of all Japanese armed forces, and to provide the proper assurances of their good faith and so on. Now, what they said about at Potsdam about Germany was that, of course, we had the Allied occupation zones, whereas Germany was never divided. I mean, Japan was never divided up like Germany was. There was all under one man, MacArthur, as the supreme commander of the Pacific forces. And Japan had 100 million people all along. They were always saying how, you know, our 100 million people. That's a lot of people. Actually, Germany had 70 million, but that was like in 1937 or so. And later on, as they annexed more areas, I guess it increased. So I don't know how you'd compare that, but at least they were comparative in size. And I always think of Japan as so small. And I don't know how the territory compares, but it doesn't seem to me that there's very much territory in Japan. But there is; they really have the people packed in there. And under the Potsdam Agreement, for Germany was democratization was called for, and that meant Germany was going to be treated as a single unit. And that would be, they have disarmament and demilitarization, but also specifically elimination of all Nazi influence. Elimination of all Nazi influence. Well, now, Hitler was not an emperor with a long pedigree, you know, of many, many generations of his ancestors being emperors. That I'm not sure how far that goes back, but you know, there's a difference in the way the current reigning government was treated, absolutely, whereas in Germany, the current reigning government was absolutely seen as not only going to be eliminated, it was criminal. It was seen as criminal, and that was never done in Japan. And the then you have for the reduction or destruction in Germany of all civilian heavy industry with war potential. I mentioned that, and including shipbuilding, machine production, and chemical factories. You know how big Germany is in their chemical, industry. And, well, all that was going to go. And restructuring of German economy towards agriculture and light industry. This is the Morgenthau Doctrine. So this was, Germany was going to be pretty much destroyed as a nation, whereas it was said definitely that Japan would not be destroyed as a nation. So now enough of that comparison. To just go through what took place in Japan and how it came about that the emperor was able to give an address to the people about what I didn't even go and try to find his exact words of his whole address. I imagine it exists somewhere, but I never got around to that. Time runs out. So the Big Six, the Japanese Government Council, were considering what to do, and they had the recommendation what to recommend to the emperor, who said he wanted something to be, he needed to have something done. They recommended to the emperor that he accept the surrender, conditions. If certain conditions were agreed to, the most important one, a guarantee of the emperor's continued position in Japanese society. Now, of course, Adolf Hitler knew that he could never try to negotiate for a continued position in German society. Wouldn't even have thought, you know, wouldn't even waste any time doing that. But they tried to do this in Japan. And at that point, since that didn't seem to be possible, the emperor decided not to surrender. And it does sound like everything had to come before the emperor, and he had to okay it or not. Even though all these others were doing the, you know, the running the government and so on, he had a whole lot to say. He wasn't just a symbol, or which is what he became later, but he was an active ruler. Now on August 6th, then the United States got serious and decided to and bombed Hiroshima with their atomic bomb, first atomic bomb explosion in history. And on August 8th and 9th, the Soviet Union invaded. The Japanese really feared that, and it had not happened. And actually, the Soviet Union refused to invade Japan. It wanted to use all of its forces in the West against Germany. And once that was over, then they started moving their troops and so on back to the East front, and were threatening Japan, but they hadn't done anything. Well, now they finally agreed. They didn't want to even, but they finally agreed to do it. I think that Britain and the United States were pushing them to do it. And at the same time, they bombed Nagasaki. So this was a huge shock to the Japanese people and politicians. So on August 9th, following that day, following all that, the Soviet Union declared war on Japan, too, at that time. Emperor Hirohito told his main assistant, Kido, to quickly control the situation because the Soviet Union has declared war and today began hostilities against us. So this was more than they could face. So on August 10th, the cabinet drafted an imperial rescript ending the war, which they presented to the allies, whoever they happened to be, and hoping that they could, you know, have some kind of a peace treaty. But let's see, can't read fast enough here. They asked, it said that in this rescript they provided, they said that there was no compromise with the prerogatives of His Majesty as a sovereign ruler. This was an important point that they had to keep. And everybody thought so because it was in the Japanese tradition that everybody served the ruler because he was a kind of a divinity. And so, you know, his well-being and his continuation was more important than anything and anybody else. So that's why that was always there in the front. And on August 12th, the emperor informed the imperial family of his decision to surrender. Now, this is kind of interesting because one of his uncles asked him whether the war would be continued if the national polity could not be preserved. And the emperor simply replied, "Of course." This is according to certain books written about it and research done. I just have to go by that. I think it means that he was saying, "Well, our political order continue as it is. You know, they're not going to just turn us upside down. And if they didn't agree to that, would we continue the war?" And the emperor said, "Well, of course." But of course, they really were not in that. By then, they knew they couldn't continue the war with any success. And those two bombs caused them to see what kind of destruction could be. And it was that they were scheduling more of them if the Japanese didn't come around. So Hirohito said, it goes without saying that it is unbearable for me to see the brave and loyal fighting men of Japan disarmed. It is equally unbearable that others who have rendered me devoted service should now be punished as instigators of the war. Nevertheless, the time has come to bear the unbearable. Well, that's a nice phrase. I like it. He goes on to say, "I swallow my tears and give my sanction to the proposal to accept the Allied proclamation on the basis outlined by the foreign minister." But you notice that he says that it's he hates to see his loyal fighting men be punished. He hates to see his people who sacrificed so much in devoted service, you know, have to go through all this. But it doesn't include himself. He is not included in those who are to be punished. He is supposed to be left out of that. And a privy council president turned to the emperor, and at that point, I guess he said this to his government people. He said, "Your Majesty, you also bear responsibility for this defeat. What apology are you going to make to the heroic spirits of the imperial founder of your house and your other imperial ancestors?" Well, there's no indication that this person got an answer. He had the right to ask the question, obviously. You know, they weren't so afraid of the emperor that they couldn't say things to him that were reasonably proper. But there were some questions about how this was coming down. But on the question of the emperor continuing to be head of state, the reply of the allies was, "From the moment of surrender, the authority of the emperor and the Japanese government to rule the state shall be subject to the supreme commander of the allied powers, who will take such steps as he deems proper to effectuate the surrender terms. The ultimate form of government of Japan shall, in accordance with the Potsdam Declaration, be established by the freely expressed will of the Japanese people." Now, this, of course, they make it sound like they're going to be tough. Well, they were tough. But, I mean, I'm not saying the Japanese got off easier life. They absolutely didn't. The same stuff happened to them, but it was a little bit different. And some of it was pretty crucial differences. But for these idiotic allies to say that, you know, the freely expressed will of the Japanese people had not had a freely expressed will, and they didn't even ask for one. And I don't know how long, if ever, you know, they were a different kind of a structure, which is what this fellow, one guy, probably, you know, relative of the emperor, meant when he said, "Are we going to retain our national polity?" Well, they had a Japanese word, kokutai, something like that, but it's supposed to mean national polity, be preserved. Well, you know, but for them to suddenly say, "Well, no, the Japanese people are going to express," if they had asked the Japanese people to express their will, they would have said, "Just bring us back, you know, let us have the emperor and let us have everything the way it's been." Nobody was complaining about that I know of. So it's also phony. But on August 14th, the Suzuki government, that's what it was called, one of the, maybe it was the prime minister or somebody was named Suzuki, notified the allies that it had accepted the Potsdam Declaration. But that wasn't a surrender, that was just accepting the Potsdam Declaration. So then on August 15th, well, I guess it was, because the next day, they had accepted that. And the next day, a recording of the emperor's surrender speech was broadcast over the radio. And as I said before, it's known that it was the first time the emperor was heard on the radio by the Japanese people. Now, I'm not saying, now maybe that means that that they heard him in person, but I find that hard to believe. But anyway, it signified signifying the unconditional surrender of Japan's military forces. And the fact is that this surrender speech couldn't understand a word of it, because he was speaking in a elite version of the Japanese language, you know, that was different from what they used. And also, they said it wasn't that good of a recording. And so it was put out on loudspeakers all over Japan. So the people were, of course, they told to come and listen to it. And as Marcus said, they were bowing to the loudspeaker, knowing that it was their emperor speaking to them. But they didn't know very well, or maybe not at all, what he said. But they knew what was happening anyway. And it said that many Japanese, now I don't know if this is correct, this is, you know, you have to take this stuff, and since I'm not a scholar on any of this, obviously, you have to take it for what is said, and it is said that many simply listened to it and then went on to their lives as best they could. It didn't make any difference. There was nothing they could do about it, you know? And they went on, and the thing is, Japan had not been attacked. Japan had not been, there had been no invasion by any foreign element on the island of Japan, unless it was in some place here or there, but far off at such a bunch of islands. But it was, you know, they hadn't seen the face of the enemy except, you know, firsthand as they had in Germany for so long. Whereas Germany had been under, had been, you know, slowly invaded for quite a while already. So by the time you came to the Battle of Berlin. And when this speech was over, they said some army and navy officers chose suicide over surrender. And so there was this, you know, people were killing themselves right there and then while the speech was going on. Now, to get back here, it says, at the time of this speech, some diehard army fanatics attempted a coup d'etat because they didn't want to surrender. They call them diehard army fanatics. Well, you know, they were the ones who didn't want to surrender, and no matter what. And they attempted this coup, but they had by conducting a full military assault and takeover of the imperial palace. It's known as a some kind of incident, and the physical recording, because of that, the physical recording of the surrender speech was hidden and preserved overnight, and the coup was quickly crushed on the emperor's order. So they couldn't succeed on that. And the surrender speech noted that the war situation has developed not necessarily to Japan's advantage. That's a quote, and ordered the Japanese to, quote, endure the unendurable in surrender. It was the first time the public, as I had said, had heard his voice, and he used the language that they, most of them, didn't speak and couldn't understand. It was the language of the well-educated and samurai families. So, so much for that speech, but the people, here it is, a large weeping crowd gathered in front of the Imperial Palace in Tokyo, because, you know, while this speech was going on, and they knew what it was saying, and they were weeping and doing what they should do, and at the same time, the sound of their cries was sometimes interrupted by gunshots as military officers present committed suicide. So this is what took place there. And then here's a little incident. At a base north of Nagasaki, some Japanese army officers, enraged at the prospect of surrender, pulled some 16 captured American airmen out of the base prison and hacked them to death with swords. Now, here's the thing, that if Adolf Hitler had given a speech, over the radio to the German people prior to his suicide. Now, first, I don't know what he would say. He had never surrendered. We'll have to get into that. You know, he had never surrendered. He never did surrender. So he wasn't going to give a speech of surrender. He turned his government over to others, hoping that they could carry on. You know, he knew the situation was as dire as it was, but he wasn't gonna surrender because he knew what surrender was. And the only thing that came out of the surrender of, and I don't, I probably would have anyway, it didn't need the surrender, was the continuation of Hirohito in Japan. They were, that would have happened anyway. We'll get to that momentarily here. So, but, you know, what would a whole lot of the military people have done? would they have done what these Japanese officers did and pull some prisoners, you know, American prisoners or this kind of, you know, and murder them and torture, you know, I mean, you know, kill them and so on out in the open, and then it would be even worse. I mean, Germans didn't like to do things like that. The Germans really didn't like things to get out of control wild. So, and I'm sure the Japanese didn't either, but they, things like that did happen because they were, they had suddenly their emperor's telling them that they had to accept this surrender and, you know, they were going to be debased, at the hands of these, big white guys. It was pretty horrible for them. So then the occupation of Japan. A few things about that. The August 19th. So this, when was this speech? The speech was on August 15th. And on August 19th, Japanese officials left for Manila. But you know, the Japanese are very, very obedient people too, even more than the Germans probably. I mean, they're very quiet and whatever they were told by their emperor they had to do, well, that's what they did. And you know, the emperor was believed to be a sort of a divinity. His ancestors were what's that word? They came from the female divinity of the sun. They were the daughters. You know, they were her offspring, the female sun divinity. That's why they're the land of the rising sun and all that. The sun is very big in their beliefs. And so, you know, he was to be obeyed, and that was it. And they were comfortable with that. Now, on August 19th, the Japanese officials went and met with Douglas MacArthur to be briefed on his plans. Now, Douglas MacArthur was the supreme commander of the Allied powers, SCAP. Just like Eisenhower was the supreme commander of the Allied powers in Europe. And, but after the zones, after they were in their different zones, Eisenhower did not have, the say over other, he suddenly only had say over the American zone. These others had say over their zones. But still, he had huge influence. And the difference between MacArthur and Eisenhower is makes for a large part, maybe mostly, the difference between the treatment of Germany and the treatment of Japan. MacArthur was not out to get anybody. He wasn't a Jew or working for the Jews that he knew of. And he would try to do what would be, you know, the best for peacekeeping and so on and satisfy everyone. So, you know, he had a very different idea of his job than Eisenhower did. On August 28th, 150 U.S. personnel flew to this prefecture, and the occupation of Japan began. They flew somewhere in Japan, and 150 of them, that was the beginning of the Japanese occupation. On August 28th, that was quite a while after the speech of surrender, which was August 15th. So on August 30th, finally MacArthur arrived in Tokyo, and he decreed some laws, and they were no Allied personnel were to assault Japanese people. No Allied personnel were to eat the scarce Japanese food. Well, that doesn't fit with what happened in Japan, in Germany. I'm going to get these words mixed up. Because in Germany, of course, they were eating the Germans' food. They were taking all the Germans' food. Germany did have food. And they were still had people growing food, and they still had things going on, and the Allies took whatever they wanted, the military personnel and so on. But MacArthur said that wasn't allowed in Japan. And he severely restricted the flying of the flag of the rising sun, their national rising sun flag, Well, in Germany, of course, the Nazi flag was totally outlawed and would have been confiscated, destroyed, and nobody could even show a little drawing of it or something, you know. But here they still were able to use their flag, and they still use it to this day. I believe it's the same one or something similar. Anyway, after the formal surrender on September 2nd, then they started their investigations into the Japanese war crimes. And the Japanese did commit a lot of atrocities, but who else was doing it? Well, you know, but I'm not going to excuse the Japanese, the kind of atrocities they carried out against a lot of these Asian peoples that they wanted to rule over. So, but you know, in the end, they indicted 25 persons as Class A war criminals. Just 25, and I imagine they were all hung, I suppose. But no, here. But it says they also indicted 5,700 persons as Class B or Class C war criminals, and of these, 984 were initially condemned to death. So we know, but I don't. Almost 5,700 Class B or Class C. So you know that's. But of those, only 984 were condemned, but only 920 were actually executed. So that's what they executed, 920 persons. 475 received life sentences. 2,944 received some prison terms. 1,018 were acquitted, and 2,079 were not sentenced or not brought to trial after all of that number. And this... The Class A charges were all tried by the International Military Tribunal for the Far East, supposed to be the similar to the Nuremberg trials, Nuremberg Tribunal in Germany, also known as the Tokyo trials. And I know they hung some people, but I didn't really come across the ones they did. But I know the high military and government leaders, but not the emperor. Now, that Douglas MacArthur insisted that Emperor Hirohito retain the throne, and he saw the emperor as a symbol of the continuity and cohesion of the Japanese people. Some historians criticize that decision, but I know his decision, I'm quite confident, was made in order to make his occupation go better, to keep the Japanese people from getting all upset, rebelling, or not cooperating, as long as they had their emperor, and he was doing what he was asked to do, and his family also, you know, his brothers, sisters, all that whole family was exonerated, and it says that SCAP, Supreme Commander for the Allied Powers, that's MacArthur. And some other group that I could never find out what it is, IPS, but I never could find out the actual name, what it stood for. And Japanese officials worked behind the scenes, not only to prevent the imperial family from being indicted, because there are a lot of people wanting to do it, but also to slant the testimony of the defendants to ensure that no one implicated the emperor. So in this case, you know, the Supreme Commander MacArthur was absolutely protecting the emperor, but for his own reasons, thinking that it would make the whole transition of Japan to a peaceful democratic nation and so on much easier. And he had to give something to the Japanese people and so on. So that's why it was done. They said that MacArthur's subordinates were working to attribute ultimate responsibility for Pearl Harbor to Tojo. And of course, Tojo's the big bad guy in the whole thing now, by allowing the major criminal suspects to coordinate their stories. Doesn't that sound like just the way they do things? You see, none of this is done on the up and up. I don't get so upset about Japan as I do about Germany. That's just my personal connection, but it's the same stuff going on, and because they wanted to spare the emperor from indictment. So they had to make up a lot of things because the emperor was guilty as much as all these others. You know, he was involved in it, but they, in order to spare him, and they had to do all kinds of shenanigans and cover up things and so on. And it says he was turned into an almost saintly figure who did not even bear moral responsibility for the war. I mean, they went so far with it. And let's see what's, you know, yeah, this thing about his divinity, he was not put on trial, but he was forced to explicitly reject the state Shinto claim that the emperor of Japan was an Arahitogami, which means an incarnate divinity, and that the Japanese imperial family was the offspring of the sun goddess Amaterasu. That's what the belief always was, but he had to reject that. But he had said in December 1945 to his vice grand chamberlain, he said to him, I guess according to this chamberlain, Kinoshita, who told this, I don't know, it is permissible to say that the idea that the Japanese are descendants of the gods is a false conception. But it is absolutely impermissible to call chimerical the idea that the emperor is a descendant of the gods. That is, he thought that, well, it was okay for him to say that this idea that they're descended from the gods is a false conception, but it would not be okay to say that it was wildly imaginary or improbable. That's chimerical, that is so. Now, I don't see the difference here. It doesn't make an impact on me, but that's what he said, and that's what they were thinking. And it says that it wasn't until 1946 that the tremendous step was made to alter the emperor's title from imperial sovereign to constitutional monarch. So that's what he was switched over to, constitutional monarch, which is like the British royal family. The British queen or king, they're constitutional monarchs, as far as I know. So they're just trying to change Japan into something like they have, you know, in the West, and turn it into, you know, an agreeable member of the world community, according to the Jewish New World Order. But it says that although he supposedly had repudiated claims to his divine status, his public position was deliberately left vague, partly because, again, General MacArthur thought him likely to be a useful partner to get the Japanese to accept the occupation. So he didn't want to upset that whole idea that these people had, and kind of let it change over time. And, you know, a big part about occupying a country or being a victor, if you don't have the people's acquiescence or the people's cooperation, if they keep fighting you, you really can't do it very well, can you? So that's a big part of convincing people that they have lost and that they need to accept that they've lost and then move on in a new and changed status. That's what one thing I think that Hitler was against, you know, Hitler was not going to go along with. And I more and more have a lot of respect for that because, you know, there a whole lot of it is psychological by convincing people. And of course it was true in this case, in both of these countries, that they didn't have any hope of success any longer in waging war. But still, you have to convince people that they've lost, that there is no hope. And once they accept there's no hope, then they give in. They give in to you. If they don't give in, you're not going to have a very easy time. I wish the German people had been more resistant. But, of course, they were just the opposite. They just started cooperating with the Americans right and left. And the others, too, the British. I don't know how much they liked the French. And of course, they didn't like the Soviets, but that was, but the thing, as we're going to the break, so I'll put this in here, that the Germans had been totally steeped in the idea that their main enemy was the Bolshevik Russian, you know, was the Soviet communist. And they feared him, and they knew the brutality there, and it was true. And they believed, even though they were always disappointed and surprised at the behavior of the American government, and, more so than the British government, they just expected more from Americans. And Germans, even today, still today, want to love Americans and want to believe in Americans. And they do, and they shouldn't, you know? They shouldn't. They're totally wrong there. But anyway, back then, even though they knew all the terrible things that Roosevelt and the Americans were doing to destroy them, they still couldn't get over the fact that they, in time, the Americans would show themselves to be, you know, the reasonable people that they thought they were and the decent people and so on, and they would much rather be with them than with the Soviets and the Russians. So that is what caused them to cooperate with America and the Western Allies so readily at the end when they were told that the war was over and there was no more fight and Hitler was gone. Well, we're going to go to the German nation and the situation and how it came down there when we get back from the break. And maybe we'll have a little time to talk about the ADL in 1913 and its 100th anniversary and what it means. And also you can call in after the break at 1-830-443-4911. So this is Carolyn Yeager saying stick around for the second half. See you then.
Im Westen und Osten, sie liegen in aller Welt, und ihre Helme verrosten, und Kreuz und Hügel zerfällt. Sie liegen verscharrt und versunken, im Massengrab und im Meer, aber es leben Halunken, und die ziehen noch über sie her. Heute tobt mit frechem Gebaren man durch Blätter und Lüge und Glanz. Sie fielen mit 18 Jahren in einem anderen Tanz. Heute tobt mit frechem Gebaren man durch Blätter und Lüge und Glanz. Sie fielen mit 18 Jahren in einem anderen Tanz. Sie waren nicht ausgezogen um Beute und schnöden Gewinn. Was heute verlacht und verlogen, es hatte für sie einen Sinn. Sie hatten ihr junges Leben nicht weniger lieb als die, heute Höhnen es hinzugeben, sei reine Idiotie. Heute macht man mit funkelnden Wagen und Dünkel und Mammon stark. Sie starben an vielen Tagen noch hinterm Stacheldraht. Heute macht man mit funkelnden Wagen und Dünkel und Mammon stark. Sie starben an vielen Tagen noch hinterm Stacheldraht. Musik. demonstrieren, mehr Freizeit bei höherem Lohn. Sie mussten ins Feld marschieren, der Vater, der Bruder, der Sohn. Sie gingen die Heimat zu schützen und haben allen entsagt, was kann uns der Einsatz nützen, hat keiner von ihnen gefragt. Sie haben ihr Leben und Sterben dem Vaterland geweiht und wussten nicht, welchen Herben und welche Erbärmlichkeit. Sie haben ihr Leben und Sterben dem Vaterland geweiht und wussten nicht, welchen Herben und welche Erbärmlichkeit. Und welche Erbärmlichkeit!
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. This is Carolyn Yeager with On the Heretics Hour on April 22nd, 2013. This is the anniversary of this whole period of time we're in now is the anniversary of very important events that took place after World War II, or at the end of World War II. And that song that we just heard by Frank Reneke, well, I just love that song. And it's such an empowering. There's so much strength in that song and just passion. In a sense, that's kind of a quiet passion, but I think he sings it. I think it's one of the best I've heard by him, in my opinion. So going back over to Europe and Germany, and we find that I'll just start out by saying that Berlin was bombarded by Soviet artillery for the first time on 20th April, which was Hitler's birthday. And by the evening of the 21st, that was yesterday, Red Army tanks reached the outskirts of Berlin. Not yesterday, but, you know, it was the anniversary of that day. And then on April 22nd, today's anniversary, at the afternoon situation conference, Hitler was informed that the orders he had issued the previous day for SS General Felix Steiner's army detachment to move to the rescue of Berlin had not materialized. In other words, you know, he could not do it. It was not possible. So Hitler declared, was very disappointed and rather upset, but he declared for the first time that is, so it is said by this Anthony Beevor, B-E-E-V-O-R, a British historian. Hitler said at that time for the first time that the war was lost. Well, the war is lost then. And he announced to the people, some people around him, that he had decided he would stay in Berlin until the end. He wasn't going to leave, and he would shoot himself when the right time came. Now, people had been urging him to leave and go south, maybe somewhere in Bavaria or even south of there, where it was still safer, or they thought he would be safer, and there are a lot of people that would be looking out for him, so on, be better than staying in Berlin. But he felt that as Führer, he needed to stay in Berlin, and he thought about that. He did consider it, and he stuck with his own decision, and that's what he continued. He wouldn't be moved from that. So on April 27th, Berlin was completely cut off from the rest of Germany. Now I'm thinking, you know, when was he going to give this speech that Marcus thinks he should give? You know, where would it fit in? Where, not so much a speech, an address to the nation about what was coming. Would he get on the radio around this time and say, well, my fellow German, my fellow Berliners, and my fellow, you know, the war is lost. That he said on the 22nd, the war is lost, and we have no hope. So do whatever you think you should do or what. We're going to endure terrible times. They knew that. They'd been saying that for a long time. Goebbels had been speaking on over the radio, and he gave his last address sometime around this very end of April. And he was saying all those things. Everybody knew it. And they knew where Hitler was and who he was with fairly, you know, sort of. And so what was he going to say? I told Marcus he was free, welcome to call in. He might not want to, but I certainly welcome him to call in and give his idea about this. So, I have not found any place in here where it would have been of any value for Hitler to get on the radio and then tell the world what he had in mind or, you know, what he was thinking about, because he was not planning a surrender. There was no talk of surrender yet. And, because he knew what the terms were and that they were unacceptable. So, that wasn't in the cards. I don't know what he would have said. On the 27th of April, according to these sources, this also is mostly from this Beevor, Berlin was completely cut off from the rest of Germany. The secure radio communications with defending units had been lost. So he still could have gotten on the regular radio, but this was radio communications, secure ones amongst the troops and so on, the commanding staff and so on. And the command staff in the bunker were depending on telephone lines for passing instructions and orders, and on public radio for news and information. So they were listening to the radio. And on the 28th of April, getting late, a BBC report originating from Reuters was given to Hitler. It reported that Reichsfuhrer SS Heinrich Himmler had offered to surrender to the Western Allies and that the offer had been declined. Well, you know, we've never heard from Himmler on this. But the BBC reported that Himmler had offered to surrender to the Western Allies and they had declined. So, you know, true or not, I guess you're supposed to take it as true. I've always mostly accepted these things I've read, but now I wonder, you know, whether I should. But anyway, they said that Himmler had implied that he had the authority to implement and support such a surrender, but they didn't accept it. And they only wanted, they had their unconditional surrender absolutely in mind, and anything other than that was not going to be accepted for even a second. So I don't really know what Himmler thought he was doing, or if he even did this, because we know that Himmler was caught. He was tortured and murdered by the British. I don't think that he was in British hands at this time, that he must have sent a message, but somehow they did get him. And so Hitler considered this treason, of course. I guess he believed it. I guess he had reason to believe it. And that was it for him, for Himmler continuing on having any part in the government. So on the 29th of April, as we know, Hitler married Eva Braun. It was after midnight, so it had been very, very early in the morning of the 29th of April. And they had a small ceremony. I've talked about that before. And after a little party that they had, a breakfast party-like, he dictated his last will and testament to Traudl Junge. And, you know, so he did leave a will and testament. He did leave his instructions. He did leave his words. He did leave words to the German people in this way, and it has survived. He signed these documents at 4 a.m. and then retired to bed. Of course, this didn't come out to the people until later, but now he appointed successors in his last will and testament, and he appointed Karl Dönitz as the new president of the Reich, and Joseph Goebbels as the chancellor of Germany, of the Reich. But Goebbels, of course, was not, he had already told Hitler he was going to commit suicide along with his wife, and they had already done so for their children. So they, you know, he wasn't going to do it, but Hitler may have thought that until somebody actually does that, they might change their mind, or whatever, but he, that's who he chose, and that's who he wrote down, and Goebbels was actually a witness to that will and testament. But, that's just the way that was. So when Goebbels committed suicide on May 1st, the day after Hitler did, that left Dönitz as the sole leader of Germany. And he did a good job. He was a good one. He was a good choice. During the day, we know that, of course, Göring was out also. He was out of the picture for Hitler by that time. So it was Dönitz, and Dönitz did well. During the day of the 29th, Hitler learned of the death of Benito Mussolini. So that he had been executed by Italian partisans, his body and that of his mistress had been strung up by their heels. They were later cut down and thrown in the gutter, where vengeful Italians reviled them. Well, that was, you know, that was on the 29th. That was the day that Hitler married Eva and was already probably figured that he would be, they would be taking their lives very soon. And when he heard that, my God, you know, that's the kind of thing that they would have liked to have done to him. And the idea of being captured by the Soviets was just totally, totally, you know, verboten. You know, that would not be allowed to happen, no matter, nobody would allow that to happen, including Hitler. So that evening, they had their final battle conference in the Führer bunker, still having battle conferences. General Weidling was in charge of the Berlin battle. He was the commander there, and he painted a stark picture of the German situation and declared that the fighting in Berlin would inevitably come to an end within the next 24 hours. So there was little time left. Hitler agreed to the breakout of troops in small groups. He knew it was the end, but, you know, he certainly knew. He wasn't in denial, but this was the way that he handled it, and he forbade the surrender of the city. He would not let Weidling surrender the city, but he agreed that small groups of troops could try breakouts. And also the people in the bunker were able, but that was the next day, the next night after his death, they did their own breakout. The ones in the bunker who wanted to do so, and some just wanted to stay and commit suicide. So there's a lot of suicide. A lot of people chose suicide, both the Japanese and the Germans, rather than turn themselves over to these to this hated enemy. So okay, by 1 o'clock, that would have been 1 a.m. on the 30th, I guess, General Keitel reported that all the forces which Hitler had been depending on to come to the rescue of Berlin had either been encircled or forced onto the defensive. So Hitler then agreed to that breakout. That's a repeat. All right, 30th of April. Hitler gave permission to Weidling, General Weidling, around 1 p.m. to try a breakout that night, for maybe all the forces. And as also to the others in the bunker, it was known that, you know, that some of them had decided, and I've read about this in several books, but including Bormann and some of the secretaries, and some other men, and some were military, some were not, some were government, but they all did this, and most of them didn't survive, but Traudl Jung did survive. The women survived, even though they were captured, but they didn't kill them. But anyway, let's see. That day, April 30th, Hitler had lunch with his secretaries, and then he and Eva said their goodbyes to all the people who were still in the bunker, and they retired to their private quarters. And at 3:30, there were gunshots, and there was a gunshot. There was a gunshot, and they were dead. And they, you know, they had poison, Eva Braun took poison and then Hitler, I think, took poison and shot himself through the temple at the same time. That is what most of the witnesses say. So, but no surrender had been made, and there was a new government. And so on May 1st, the following day, the message that Hitler was dead came from the Germans over their radio, the Reichssender, Hamburg. Just the party in Hamburg was still functioning well, and it sent transmissions across all of Germany to the fact that, that Hitler was dead. And it announced that an important broadcast would soon be made. I don't know. That was the broadcast. And then following that came an announcement by Great Admiral Karl Dönitz, who had been appointed as Hitler's successor in Hitler's will, and he called upon the German people to mourn their Führer, who died the death of a hero in the capital of the Reich. So the people were not left with nothing. They weren't just left floating, you know, in flux or something. They did get the message, and then they did hear from Karl Dönitz, who they all knew, and they knew that he was a good, loyal German, and that he, you know, they would do what, you know, they would follow him to whatever he said that they should do. What else could anybody do? And he said that did I read this part that Dönitz said that their Führer had died the death of a hero in the capital, and he stated that his only aim for continuing the war was to save Germany from destruction by the advancing Bolshevist enemy. That's what he told the people, and that they were, and also that message was, of course, to the Allies, to the enemy, that he had to continue the war because, you know, all kinds of Germans were coming from the east to the west, trying to get out of the hands of the Bolsheviks. And so that was their aim from that point onward, was to save as many Germans as possible from this enemy that was in the east, from the communists. And as I said before, and I know you all understand, the German people were well indoctrinated, if you want to say, to understanding that the Bolshevist was the great enemy, the communists and the Soviet Union was a great enemy, and they wanted to make friends with the West against this enemy, but the West would never cooperate. So this was the sickening part of the whole thing, and the West certainly was wrong, because you know, we can just look today at what happened to these great powers: the United States, the United Kingdom, France, and Italy, I guess, but Italy was an ally up until the very end. But look at them today. Look at these great victors. Every one of those countries is falling apart and caving in. And the United States is caving in so bad. I hope it just falls apart. I'm waiting for it. I want it to, because it's so in the wrong. It has gone so, it's just in the hands of the devil. It's just so far gone. And yet, look at Germany. For as much as Germans have been enslaved by basically the United States government and military, they still have retained something that the others have totally lost. And they are the ones who could come back. They are the ones who could lead something better in the world, if it were at all possible. So, you know, it's just interesting talking about what it means to lose, when you lose, and who really, you know, do the sometimes the winners end up being the losers, and the losers end up being the winners, but it's all over a period of time. You can't see it in the moment that you're in. Anyway, Dönitz added that, and what a fine man he was. I just think he was such a fine man. as far and for so long as achievement of that aim was impeded by the British and the Americans, he would be forced to carry on Germany's defensive fight against them as well. So, you know, he made it clear that the aim of saving Germany from destruction of the Bolshevist enemy was being impeded by the British and Americans who were fighting Germany. And therefore, he was forced to fight them. But he would like not have to fight them, and that, you know, so that they could fight the Bolshevists, but they were forcing a fight against them. That was so well put, and he understood that so well. So again, you know, I ask, in all this time, what would, you know, how does Marcus feel that somehow the Germans were left adrift and left, what does he say here? Left in emotional trauma and lost because Hitler didn't speak to them, didn't address them over the radio before he died. Or he sent, again, the whole point is that before signing the surrender, well, then he would be saying that Hitler should have stayed alive and should have gone south or tried to break out and stayed alive until the time of the signing of the surrender. Well, it wasn't in Hitler to ever sign a surrender, and he knew that. Here's how I see it. He knew at that point when his time was up, when his role was over, because there was nothing of what he was not just known for, but what he was there to accomplish could no longer be accomplished by him. He had no means whatsoever left to do it. And so his role was over, but he was not going to continue on in some other role that was not natural to him, and it was not part of what he wanted to leave behind. That's the way I see it. So I just think, I won't belabor this anymore. I think that's my answer to Marcus, and let's see if there's any more part there to answer. Yeah, and I don't think that, I said this already, that Japan's emperor's address did that much to, but it didn't hurt anything, you know, it didn't hurt anything, but it was a different situation. And he was there, and he survived, and he continued on. He lived for a long time after that, and he remained emperor of Japan. So it was, you know, he was allowed to do that. So there you go. Now let me find my place back here. This is interesting how this surrender took place. Now, what would... Okay. All right. I think I took care of that. I'm just repeating myself. Again, you know, the Jews were not out to get the Japanese. So that was... They were treated differently. The Jews were out to get the Germans. And let's see, I haven't gone past that part about Eisenhower. You know, Eisenhower was the key here. Eisenhower was a real villain. Eisenhower was doing the will of the international Jewry and of the Jews in the Roosevelt government and so on. And he was the bad guy. So on May 6th, the German forces Germany hadn't surrendered yet, but in May 6th, German forces in Breslau surrendered. Of course, Berlin had fallen to the Soviets, but this fortress Breslau had been surrounded and besieged for months, and they had to surrender to the Soviets. Yuck! They had to surrender to the Soviets, and on May 6th also, 30 minutes after the fall of that fortress Breslau, General Alfred Jodl arrived in Reims, France, following Dönitz's instructions to offer to surrender all forces fighting the Western Allies, because Breslau was kind of the last stand there, and they didn't want to abandon these fighters who were there, but they finally had to surrender. This was the same negotiating position that von Friedeberg had initially made to Montgomery, and he was it was dismissed by Montgomery. But Jodl went to Reims and made it to Eisenhower. And Eisenhower, upon hearing that, threatened to break off all negotiations unless the Germans agreed to a complete unconditional surrender. So I guess the offer to surrender all fighting forces is not exactly an unconditional surrender. And, of course, you're always trying to avoid that. And they were. But at this point, now here's this absolutely nasty, nasty Eisenhower who should be exposed for the rat that he is instead of a national hero of the Americans. Eisenhower explicitly told Jodl that he would order Western lines closed to German soldiers, forcing them to surrender to the Soviets. If they didn't, you know, if they didn't agree to this complete unconditional surrender, Eisenhower was going to close off their retreat to the West and force them to surrender to the Soviets, because they were all trying to not surrender to the Soviets and to surrender to the Americans. And as I've said, it was hardly a very good choice that they had, because but they had no idea that the Americans would treat them the way that they did. But this is the difference between Eisenhower and MacArthur, which was a huge difference in the way these two nations were treated, and the kind of attitude that was there toward them. Because in Germany, Eisenhower and his group, well, he forced people to treat the Germans like that, and it was just pure hatred. So, I mean, he was already putting soldiers in those meadow camps. That is just the biggest crime. This is one of the worst crimes I've ever heard of. Now, Jodl then sent a signal to Dönitz Dönitz was in Flensburg, where they had formed their government. It was called the Flensburg government because that's where it was located. And he informed him of Eisenhower's position, what Eisenhower threatened him with. So, shortly after midnight, Dönitz accepted the inevitable and sent a signal to Jodl authorizing the complete and total surrender of all German forces. Now, I don't know how that is different from the surrender of all forces fighting the West. Oh, I know what it was. Oh, now, I'm sorry, I'm so slow. They weren't going to surrender to the Soviets. They're only going to surrender to the Western Allies. But Eisenhower said, you're going to surrender to totally and completely, or we're going to close off your retreat. So that there was no advantage then. So they had to surrender all German forces, including whatever was in the East. And they had to surrender to the Soviets, too. That's how nasty this whole thing was. So, okay, on the morning of... On the morning of May 7th at 2 a.m., almost 3 a.m., at the SHAEF, that's the Supreme Headquarters of Allied European Forces or something, under the control of Eisenhower, Alfred Jodl, who was the Chief of Staff of the German Armed Forces High Command, signed this unconditional surrender document. Must have been just, you know, what it takes to do that. I'd be throwing up, I think. Signed this unconditional surrender document for all German forces to the Allies. And Franz Behmy announced the unconditional surrender of German troops in Norway on May 7th. And then, you know, little by little, different faction, different groups, different troops here and there were surrendering their weapons. And on May 8th, Field Marshal Wilhelm Keitel, who was above Jodl, he was the supreme something or other of the supreme command under Hitler, and other German OKW representatives traveled to Berlin, and that's where they had to sign this surrender document, surrendering to Soviet forces in the presence of General Georgi Zhukov, you know, the big General Zhukov. And this took place in, that's the picture I used, that this took place in Karlshorst. So now it was all over for the Germans for sure. Nothing left. And but not all commanders obeyed the order to surrender. The largest contingent not to do so was the Army Group Center under the command of General Field Marshal Ferdinand Schirner, who had been promoted to Commander-in-Chief of the Army on April 30th in Hitler's last will and testament. Schirner was an Austrian and was a very, very tough guy, very controversial. A lot of people hated him. They say a lot of the soldiers hated him. But Hitler and the people in Berlin liked him because he got things done, even though he was so tough on his soldiers. But he did get things done. Anyway, they held out until May 11th, 12th. There's more of a story there, but I don't have time to go into it, so I won't. And Karl Dönitz was acting as if he were head of the German state, which is like the way they did in Japan. You know, they still had their state and their people in charge of it, even though they had to kowtow to the Allied Supreme Command. But that's what the Dönitz government was doing. But the Allies decided that they didn't need to recognize this. And on May 12th, they went to Flensburg and took quarters aboard a ship to deal with this Dönitz government. But then, you know, they said, well, we don't have to do this, you know, and we're just arrest these people and we'll take over. So on May 23rd, on Eisenhower's orders and with the approval of the Soviets, an American Major General Rooks summoned Dönitz aboard the Patria, not telling him what it was all about. And he had no idea. He summoned him aboard this ship that they had, that they were staying, had their headquarters in, and communicated to him then that he and all the members of his government were under arrest. And they arrested him on the spot, who was supposed to be the head of the German government. That's the kind of respect they showed. Zero. But then the Allies had a problem because they realized that although the German armed forces had surrendered unconditionally, Supreme Allied Command had failed to use a document created by the European Advisory Commission, and so there had been no formal surrender by the civilian German government. It was just a military surrender. And this was considered very important. I don't know how they think they've gotten around it, but people today say, you know, it's still in effect because the German Reich never surrendered, and there's never been any kind of treaty between them saying so and coming to some conclusion. So it still exists, and that's part of this whole thing that's going on. But of course, it's who has the power, and we know who has the power right now, so it's kind of a moot point, but it is a point. And it said that this was important, just as this relates back to 1918 and World War I, when the civilian government surrendered, but not the military. And that was used later by Hitler and other people to create the stab in the back argument. Well, this is written in an unfriendly manner, but you know that the civilian government signed a surrender and stabbed the military in the back. The military had not surrendered. So in this case, it's the other way around. The military surrendered, but the civilian government didn't surrender. So maybe Hitler did a good thing there. And, well, I'm sure he did. He always did a good thing. And the Allies they didn't want to allow this to go on. That's why they got rid of that. That's one of the reasons why they got rid of that Flensburg government headed by Dönitz, because they didn't want any kind of a civilian government for Germany that would say later, well, we never surrendered. We're the real government once they got a little stronger. So they just got rid of it, arrested them all. And, you know, Donitz was one of the ones who was hung. This great man was hung, who had not really done anything wrong, had never committed any atrocities, but they dreamed up a few things they could use. And they got rid of them all and put on their own government in its place. So now let's see. I had something. Oh, I did. I talked about that already. Okay, good. All right. So there we have that. And I'm going to go now to some few instances. You know, all of this that's going on. Okay, let's see. It's all about Jews and anti-Semitism when you get right down to it. They can't tolerate that Jews are not wanted. They can't tolerate that. So all these wars and all this stuff goes on in order to save the Jews. And now we have, there's some stuff about the emperor's responsibility for war crimes, but I'll just leave that. The fact is that of most of the things that are considered the war crimes by the Japanese, the emperor knew about it, and he was in conferences about it and so on. So that all has been, you know, was just pushed under the rug so that he could not be indicted. But we've already covered all that. So the latest story that just came out today. Again, these things are put out by the Jews in their press. This was in the Jerusalem Post. But it is the report by the United States State Department. But it's by that special anti-Semitism, what do you call it? They have a special section there in the U.S. State Department that's all Jews. And they're in charge of this monitoring anti-Semitism all around the world. That's what it's called. And it used to be, for a while it was this woman, Hannah Rosenthal or Rosenblum or something, but now it's not her. It's a person that doesn't even have a really Jewish last name, but I didn't look it up for this story. I looked at it before, but I forgot now who he was. But the latest report that they came out with is just a bunch of baloney. It says that the State Department, has their 2012 reports, you know, on countries all around the world where they think there's too much anti-Semitism. And what they point out in this 2012 report, or for 2012, just coming out now, is Venezuela is the number one problem. Venezuela. And too much anti-Semitic statements being made in Venezuela. And then the second one is Ukraine. The Jewish community is very concerned in Ukraine over government and opposition candidates in elections trying to use anti-Semitism in their public rhetoric and so on. And then goes on to they talk a lot about the Ukraine, and they're very concerned there. There's somebody named Svoboda of the far-right Freedom Party. He won more than 10% of the vote in Ukraine's parliamentary election in October. And he's supposedly anti-Semitic. So that's all good news, all very good news for us, but they don't like it. And then the other one they talk about is Hungary, as I brought up before. Well, they don't like what's going on in Hungary. It's all about the Jobbik Party. And, you know, they exaggerate all this stuff because the Jobbik Party is doing well, but it's not as strong as you'd wish it would be. That's for sure. And they're not in power. It's another person from another parties that are in power. It's not the Jobbik Party. And then the fourth one they're unhappy with is Greece. That's not number one. It's number four, because I guess they think they can handle what's in Greece, or maybe Greece is a smaller country. And then again, there's not that many Jews there. But anyway, this is the kind of thing they come out with. And the Jews play it up and play it up and play it up, even though nobody else is too very interested in it. And it's not a big deal either. And this is leading into the ADL, 1913, and the 2013 anniversary. But there's another couple other articles here real quick about Poles and Jews. Jewish groups protest plans to create a Gentile statue in Warsaw Ghetto. This is so hilarious. This was in the Daily Mail, April 12th. And you know, there's all this attention now on the Warsaw Ghetto uprising. They're trying to make as much out of that as they possibly can. And now there is some Polish person created a statue of a righteous Gentile who was trying to save Jews in the Warsaw Ghetto. I think it's a symbolic person. You know, it's just the righteous Gentile who is working to help the Jews. It's been put up in the Warsaw Ghetto. I think it has been put up there. And then these Polish Jews are complaining about it. They don't want it there because it's not a Jew. Even if it's a righteous Gentile, it's not a Jew. Let me try to get this here. They want it to be put on the outskirts. They say, well, it's right in the center of the ghetto, and we want to save that for just Jews, you know, just statues and memorials and so on to the Jews. And we don't want a Gentile in there, even if he is righteous. So they said that maybe it'd be okay if he was on the outskirts of the ghetto. That would be all right. And this is, there's a lot of noise going on about that. Isn't that pathetic? That just goes to show what these Jews are all about. They can't accept anybody but themselves. And the last little story here was from April 16th. And this is very interesting. A poll says that there's high anti-Semitism among Warsaw teens. Warsaw, Poland, here's some of the figures they came up with. They said, now let me get the number. This was a pretty big group of about 20 high schools they went to. And yeah, 20 Warsaw high schools and polled these students. And they found that 40, but you know who conducted the poll? Jews. Because they're working on a project to make Poland more Jew-friendly. And they had to find out, get this information. So they did this polling, and they have the money to do it. And so this is their results. They say 44% of these high school students said they would be unhappy to have a Jewish neighbor. They thought that was just terrible, so high. 44%, it is high. In the survey, it was 1,250 students. 2 in 5 said they would not like to have a Jewish classmate, and 61% said they would be upset if their partner turned out to be a Jew. Well, I guess, but you know, 61% said it would upset them if they, you know, I don't know if it means marriage partner or just somebody they're living with, but if they turned out to be a Jew and they hadn't known that. That's pretty good. That's pretty good. They said that, they go on and on complaining about it. And I just say, why do the Jews never ask if they're the cause? Why do they never ask why these people have this animosity toward them? They don't. They just say over and over again that it's something wrong with these Gentiles, and they need training, they need educational programs, they need social campaigns and so on to improve their mental health and make them more Jew-friendly. So, now, you know, this anniversary, this anniversary should be played up more. This 2013, the 100th anniversary of the Anti-Defamation League. And it just came to my attention, sorry to say, that it is also the 100th anniversary of the murder of Mary Fagan by this Leo Frank, who, and the Jews have managed to put out in the mainstream media that Leo Frank wasn't the murderer of this little girl and rapist of this little girl, that he was framed because he was Jewish, and it was all a terrible thing because of all the anti-Semitism that existed in this country at that time, and therefore that's why they started the Anti-Defamation League later on in that year to defend Leo, well, because there was this big effort to defend Leo Frank by Jews everywhere. And there was the B'nai B'rith had been the organization that existed to defend Jews and to promote Jewish interests and to attack those who attacked Jews, you know, and to fight for Jews and so on. It's a B'nai B'rith, which is a kind of a Freemasonic order that's all Jewish, only Jews allowed in there. And I've talked about that before, but so they needed more. They needed more. Of course, Jews were going down there to Atlanta, Georgia, to that trial and working for the Frank defense, the Leo Frank defense and so on. And Leo Frank was either the owner or the son of the owner. I don't know if he was managing it, of this pencil factory in Atlanta, Georgia, which was, you know, they were wealthy people, the Franks. Not the richest Jews in the world, but wealthy. And he was also, he had been appointed the president? Anyway, the head of that order of B'nai B'rith in Atlanta, his lodge in the year before, in 1912. So here he was, the head person, the head of the B'nai B'rith of Atlanta, Georgia, and here he was convicted of murder, rape and murder, and it was proven, but the Jews managed to get to the judge, and you should know this story fairly well, and get him to commute the sentence after he was found guilty and sentenced to hanging, you know, sentenced to death, and the governor of Georgia commuted the sentence to life in prison. And this made the people so angry that they went and somehow got him in prison and took him out and lynched him. And this is portrayed as this ugly, hateful anti-Semitism of these white Southern men who killed this innocent man who somehow became innocent because the governor had changed his sentence, but he didn't say that he was innocent. But the Jews went on this huge campaign to make out that he was innocent and come up with this kind of fakey proof, which isn't any good. But they managed, because of their power of the press and so on, to get it, make most people believe it. And if you look up on Wikipedia, the Leo Frank trial and case and so on, it will come right out and say, it's like it was written by Abe Foxman. It will come right, it comes right out and says that this was an anti-Semitic incident where Jews were blamed for something they didn't do. And it's, you know, because of all the anti-Semitism that existed in 1913 and crud like that. So it's just absolutely stupid. But this is, I'm real interested in this too, because this fits so perfectly what we are talking about in the International Jew. You know, the readings that we're doing now on Thursdays on the International Jew program, they're getting to be so good. And it's showing, because it's around this time. Of course, now we're in 1921. It was 1920 when Ford and his writers and research people were, you know, started the chapters or the different newspaper issues. It started in 1920, and now it's 1921. It goes on for another year or so. I don't know that they've mentioned this yet. I mean, they should have mentioned it, but I don't know that this has come up. Maybe they didn't touch, maybe they were unwilling to touch it. It's just the same thing that they're talking about. The same thing where the Jews are refusing to find anybody of their persuasion, any Jew, you know, whether they think of it as religious or as ethnic, to be guilty of anything. Anytime anything they call it is defamed, they're going to fight against it. They won't accept. This just goes to show that that's not honest, that they're totally dishonest and they're lying about everything. But this is what they have to do because they're afraid that because they know how criminal they are. They know how deep their criminality goes. And this Leo Frank was what he did to this 13-year-old girl is just disgusting. And the people are up in arms, and they know that the whole population, if they knew what Jews really did, they would be up in arms and kill them and kick them out. And if they wouldn't leave, they'd kill them. They'd lynch them all. They'd do this or they'd do that. They'd round them up. They wouldn't allow it. And they know that. So they can't allow it to come out. And that's exactly what's going on with Jews. They gain power where they need to gain it. And we know those places, you know, we don't need to keep repeating them. The media, the judiciary, amongst the academics and the universities and amongst the science groups and government and so on. They, and entertainment, any kind of communications, so that they can put out their pro-Jewish propaganda again and again and again constantly, and they can attack and discredit that which is telling the truth about them. And so in 1913, when this was going on with this Leo Frank, which was a big, big blow to the Jews, this head of the local B'nai B'rith, it wasn't just a little one in Atlanta, Georgia, and the kind of charge that he was found guilty of was a huge bad mark on Jews, and so they wanted to erase it. They can't allow there to be any bad Jews, and we need to remember that there aren't any good Jews. They might not be bad Jews, but they're still Jews, and they're still going to, in some way, shape, or form, support Jewishness existing, because just by having Jewishness existing in your nation, and Jews being able to form these organizations and do all this stuff, because of the way they go about it and their talent in their sneaky kind of I can't even think of the words for it, but we know what it is. Because of that, you're never going to be free of this terrible things that they do. And the crime that they carry out and how they get away with it. So the idea of 1913 and the Anti-Defamation League being formed simply to allow Jewish crime to continue. That's what it is. That's what the ADL is. It is set up to defend Jewish criminals and make it safe for Jews to commit crime, to continue to commit crimes, and the crimes they commit become so abhorrent. I mean, Tanstoffel has been talking about the organ transplants and the organ sales or organ theft in sales and so on, which is worldwide and run by Jews, and other things that they do that are just so disgustingly evil. And now this anniversary of Mary Fagan's death and that trial with Leo Frank should really get a lot of publicity. I would like to talk about it some more, but I don't really know that there's not that much to say. VNN Forum has a nice thread on it with lots of good information. And right now I have a, I'm looking at a, I'll just tell you, there's a website, www.leofrank.org, real simple, leofrank.org. And it's, you've probably been there maybe already. I've been there before, but it's quite, it's pretty long. I think it has quite a lot to it. I didn't have time to look at everything, but it has lots of links, subjects and links and so on. You can find just about anything, and it tells the truth. And you know, there's an autopsy report that you can read. Where is that? It's on the front page. It says then a little bit down in the text, Mary Fagan autopsy report, 1913. I read that, and I saw that picture of her, that autopsy picture, which I don't, I've probably seen it, but I forgot it. But it shocked me because I didn't remember ever seeing it before. And there's a picture of her clothing and so on. And then there's a whole report by this Dr. H. F. Harris, who said what he found when he conducted the autopsy on her. It's just enough to make you furious. And they know that when we really get to the truth about these things, you know, we will become enraged and want to find whoever is the perpetrator and put him out of, you know, or take his life. That's what they're afraid of. And that's what they did for Leo Frank. Well, they did not save his life, but they have managed to rehabilitate his reputation, except for the people who know better and, you know, who are not going to fall for that garbage. But most of the people of the world, or this country, will read what it says on Wikipedia and stuff like that and in the mainstream, and they'll say, well, yeah, I guess there was another time where the Jew got blamed for something. They'll fall for it. It's too bad. And this is the kind of thing that we need to get really going on. I mean, we can't be so reasonable that we're just going to not want to rock the boat too much or look wild. Well, I've got 10 seconds. It's time to say goodbye, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for listening to this program. I didn't get a call from Marcus or from anybody, but I will be back again next week. And do tune in on Thursday for the International Jew, where we will be talking about this subject. Good night.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit Carolyn's website at carolynyager.com.